What we're doing is setting up all the required infrastructure and additional tooling to help a part of this value back to them.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%.
GM, GM, everyone. My name is Dugachi, the host of Scraping Bits. Today, I'm with another MEV searcher, Kustrin. How's it going?
Yeah, things are going well. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you on. It's hard to get MEV searchers on and actually be public-facing, but I think now, with the trend of block building, it's more important than ever to be a face value in this kind of world. So man, just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, I agree. I am a co-founder and developer at Crypto. We are a company who's doing searching and actively working on a block builder. We've been operating behind the scenes for a few years. And as of recently, we've decided to be more public about our work. And for me specifically, my blockchain journey initially started as a hobby, later developed in a job, in addition to a full-time job, and soon after resulted in an established company, Crypto. Initially, we've been developing SEX trading strategies. And around 2020, we switched to on-chain searching. And since then, we have tried a lot of different strategies, from arbitrage and liquidations, as well as IDO sniping and sandwiches. And just to be clear, we are not running bots for the later two, since we find them immoral and we believe they're hurting the DeFi ecosystem. We just explore them to get familiar with how they're actually working. So during this time, we have basically built an MEV bot, a single instance, which is capable of running all of these strategies in one. It's running as a separate independent instance from the Ethereum node written in Kotlin and Java. And it's working in combination with highly optimized smart contracts that we developed. So we also developed, and the beginning of the November also open sourced the Ethers KT library. That's an async high-performance Kotlin library for interacting with EVM-based blockchains, which is targeting the GVM and Android platforms. So you can find it on our GitHub or even on our website. For the strategies as they are, I personally am most interested in researching new ones and figuring out how they can leverage the new protocols that are appearing every day. I really like to explore and connect the dots between them. For example, in the past half of the year, I've been actively researching how the cross-domain strategies are working because I believe they are natural evolution of atomic arbitrage. So yeah, it's a bit about me and Crypto. We're a company of great minds with awesome ideas, and I'm really looking forward to share the ideas in the future when the time comes.
Definitely. I think there's a lot to talk about here, a lot to digest. So when you first got into MEV searching, what was that journey like to initially get into it? Because it is quite hard. You need capital, you need infrastructure to build the bot, and you can still have all those things, but still not be successful. Because it is like a cutthroat game. And I think getting into block building as well is even more cutthroat because it literally is winner takes all. When there's a block, there's only one person gets the block. Whereas with MEV, it's a searcher sense, you have a list of transactions, right? A set of transactions. Someone can take a transaction, but there's a lot of other transactions that you can use, right? So it's not necessarily winner takes all, but it is to some degree. And so how did you really get into searching at the start of your journey?
Yeah, as I said, initially it was all a hobby. Me and you guys working with some tech strategies and also looking at other crypto stuff. And at that time, we figured out something interesting is going on the Ethereum blockchain. We didn't know at that time what that is. So we just went dig into and found that there's some IDO sniping going on. So at the time when we found this information, we were still doing our regular jobs, but the things were getting more and more interesting. So we started to developing the audio sniping bot. And over time, we just figured out that there is no need to do a regular job if you're doing at least that big one afterwards. So we just quit and focus solely on the searching.
Doing IDO sniping or LB sniping is actually quite difficult, or maybe it wasn't at the time, but you're not even just competing with other searches. It's a funny game, actually, because you're competing against also the project, which 9 times out of 10, they rug. It's kind of its own mini MEV game. Or are you talking about like actual pre-sales and not liquidity sniping?
The liquidity sniping is the thing that was the most interesting at the time. The other rocks are happening afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a different game in that world. It's like a mini world within the macro. I don't know if Flashbots were around when you did it, but what was the game like versus these LP deployers? Were you like the rugging dynamic, you know, like were you getting rugged by them? Were you beating other bots and like selling it before them? What was that kind of environment like back then?
At that time, when we started everything, there was no Flashbot bundles. They came a few months afterwards. So it was a pretty risky game. We were rocked once, but because we weren't too careful. If you look and waited long enough, the smart contract of the token is actually published in the public channels. There was still a few minutes to the actual TGE event or add liquidity. So you had a few minutes to set up everything correctly. But yeah, as I said, things were pretty interesting. Initially, on our first sniping that we tried it, we managed to get into the same block, but we are far behind from the liquidity. We just dug into the some optimizations, also increased our infrastructure from 1 to 10 nodes. And this worked pretty okay. We managed to get closely, but then on the peak, we just decided to YOLO and set up servers in every possible region and zone there is.
Yeah.
I think there was around 90 servers running at that time, and we all set up them early in the morning. And of course, we needed to automate this process so we could spin them in seconds. It actually really paid off. But for the next ones, we were already out of the game, but not because of the speed or courage issues, but because the Flashbot bundles appeared.
Yeah, yeah. What was the dynamic like back when there were no Flashbot bundles? What was like the most interesting things you would see versus today's world where, you know, it's a completely different game now?
Yeah, it's a completely different game and it's not so risky as it was because at that time you really needed to be careful what you're actually doing because every transaction was mined on chain. You needed to develop a smart contract with a lot of checks inside it. So you weren't buying on the top, you had some thresholds in it. And if they were not respected, sorry, you didn't get that IDO. The transaction actually failed and then you waited and tried the next one. And today when the Flashbots are really, really, really big ecosystem, a lot of people are just sending transactions. They're not adding some security features in the smart contract and so on because they rely on this bundle feature. If the bundle doesn't get over, if it fails, it doesn't get mined afterwards. So yeah, it's a completely different game. And I believe it's less riskier for the searchers.
And it also helps sandwiching as well in hackers because there's like little to no risk. As you said, if it fails, there's no downside really. It's just upside. Whereas if you fail in the public mempool, then there's a whole bunch of things that can happen. Someone can apply a strategy to you or you may not get the position you wanted in the block and it still confirms. There's just a lot of different things that's happening. But you know, you also did liquidations, right? So how was that game different to the LP sniping?
So yeah, with the LP sniping, you're basically competing for a single prize. Here with the liquidations, there is not just one user that gets eventually liquidated at a given time, but usually there are some walls when 10, 20, or maybe even 100 users are actually getting liquidated. You still need to be fast and so on, but there's more opportunities you can actually win. So from that point of perspective, it's not just one single winner, but usually there is more of them. The fastest, the most optimized ones are taking the biggest liquidations, but then after some threshold, they just stop competing because it's not interesting for them. And at that point, the other users or searchers can get in and compete for the rest.
It's like vultures coming in for the scraps and then kind of taking over. What was the transition like from obviously doing the searching with like a small group, but then expanding into where you are now with crypto?
Yeah, it was a pretty interesting journey. Initially, everybody wanted to do everything because everything was so interesting.
Yeah.
We just didn't want to miss things. Over the times, we figured out we cannot get all information about ourselves, so we need to take care of some part of it and then share the necessary information with the others, and then we can together build something. And over the years we've been working, we also connected with the Eden Network guys, and we worked them on a different researching tasks. They are a team of exceptionally talented people that are building and providing multi-chain infrastructure. And together we were basically researching and building tools around the MEV ecosystem to better understand what's actually going on in the dark forest.
Yeah, interesting. And what kind of tools would they be? Obviously, they're monitoring tools, but, you know, I think it's hard. You would obviously have an archive node or something similar, and then you have to establish connections between different protocols and whatnot. You know, I've always been interested in generalized front runners. They've always been quite interesting, but I think the use of flash bots and the private mempools kind of ruined it a little bit, because then you can't front run like the top dogs, really. But man, and then you kind of transition into block building, right? Why even do that? It's actually a big trend now when I talk to a bunch of searchers for, I guess, obvious reasons once you are a searcher. Why did you guys decide to get into block building?
So yeah, since the merge, our focus has been on the block building. What we believe is that the block building is the place where all of the existing searchers will be looking at in the future. Why? Because it basically represents searching on a much greater scale. What that means is you're not just constructing and ordering bundles with a few transactions, but you're actually collecting and packing them together, doing some different ordering things, so you can actually build a whole, the most profitable block. So yeah, we've been researching and experimenting with different building strategies and tested many different approaches. In addition, we have also concentrated on how the node works internally. We did a lot of optimizations around texture fetching and its simulations, particularly the execution, reverting, and state fetching for a given transaction. And this was very useful in the process of block building because it allowed us to try more block stack combinations for a given slot. So in the following days, we also open sourced the Aragon builder, which we were using for experimenting as an alternative to Geth builder. And with that all acquired knowledge and insights, we are now building a builder that we believe will be able to compete with today's top builders.
Yeah, I just released one on Rsync, and it's just a monopoly, really, when you think about builders. It's Rsync, Titan, and Beaver. Rsync had like 30% yesterday. Beaver had 30%. I think Titan had like 20. But it's always jumping up and down between the three of them and no one really else. So what do you think? Why do you think the reason is behind them basically monopolizing block building? Obviously, there's exclusive order flow, but there's got to be something else on top of that as well, right?
I think that's the most crucial one. I believe there is a lot of private deals being made behind closed doors, and a lot of these builders are also now vertically integrating an entire stack. So they're running searcher, builder, relay, and in some extreme cases, also integrating their own validators. And also on top of that, each one of them is trying to build as big as possible private transaction mempool of exclusive transactions. So as you mentioned, this today is a big threat for Ethereum blockchain decentralization because such entities are given great power that can be used for different purposes, which could also include much more rigid transaction censorship. So I've seen many different experiments on how to prevent this threat. And just a few days ago, I read the most interesting one from the Fastlane Labs operating on Polygon. So what they suggested is basically that all of the private bundles are broadcasted back into the public mempool. And this simple idea is not just solving this, let's call it privatization problem, but also greatly reduces the bad MEV. And why is that? Because all of the transactions are visible in the mempool. So that means the sandwichers and IDO snipers are subject to a much greater risk because their previously atomic bundles could now be potentially unbundled. But there are also some weaknesses in this idea. In general, this idea would probably force more builder search or vertical integrations to appear, because you will need to insert your private transactions at the block building level to avoid the public mempool.
Yeah.
So yeah, at the moment, no solution is perfect and there are trade-offs with each one. And I don't know what will the future bring us. In general, as I mentioned, that Ethereum could not be so decentralized if there is only three entities that are building blocks, because they can just say, okay, we will not do this. And then you have a pretty small percentage of other builders of the network who could do this thing that these top guys just decided to not do it anymore.
Yeah, 100%. It's really becoming like a business orientated field. You know, it's not strictly you can be an anon and just work in your basement and make millions anymore. You know, when someone's in control of basically building every block, they don't necessarily have to add you. And I mean, they can even run their own searches on these blocks as well. It's basically the evolution of searching, but it comes at like a much higher cost of, you know, needing prerequisites to even compete. You have to pay for much larger infrastructure costs. There's a lot more code you have to read and write, you know, building the builder itself, making the algorithms work. And in my mind, it's kind of like fuzzing, like heuristically and all that, but you could probably apply some AI models to really do some stuff. I could be wrong, but that's how I would do it. I've never done it before. So naively speaking, it just makes logical sense in that way.
It's not just that, because everybody is doing searching today. You have to apply a lot of business and other things to be a successful block builder.
Yeah. I mean, you don't really have to do business to be a successful MEV searcher. But now that it's kind of evolving into this, yeah, the exclusive order flow is a big no-no.
Yeah.
It's not decentralized, you know, and that's the whole point of Ethereum. So, man, what are you guys going to do to even compete then? Because how would you, if the 20% that makes the 80% is really just exclusive deals, then how do you compete with the people that have made exclusive deals? Because then, you know, these top searchers are already working with them. So how can you get other, you know, order flow?
At the moment, what we're doing is basically setting up all the required infrastructure and additional tooling to help us faster iterate the block building strategies and also execute simulations and monitor our efficiency. And with this, we're also in the process of setting up and releasing an RPC point endpoint, which will have additional incentives for dApps and searchers. We are still playing around with how exactly that would work, but the general idea is if we can use the transactions from dApps and searchers to build an even more valuable block, then we will be returning part of this value back to them. And with this, we believe we would be a pretty interesting endpoint. A lot of stuff today is happening not just on single chain, on multiple ones. So that is why we already explored and researched how these things are going and also built a simple proof of concept to see how such things will work. We believe we can augment the block builder value also with such strategies that we're running by ourselves and are actually helping the DeFi ecosystem. So here I'm particularly targeting the arbitrage one.
Yeah, I think right now a very unexplored area of builders is the features. As you said, like paying back, I guess, fees and paying them a part of the MEV or for the basically transactions incentivizes people to use your RPC over someone else's, or your endpoint rather, which I don't know what the other people do feature-wise. I don't think they really do anything. I could be wrong, but it's not like, I think that could be a big differentiator aside from, you know, exclusive order flow. Because I guess from the programming side, you really have like two options or three options. You have like latency, maybe four. You have latency, the amount of transactions you have in, you're bringing in, which you could just link to every mempool, I guess, across the world, via the nodes and like gossiping. But then, yeah, like how good is your profit algorithm to like order these transactions? And then, yeah, the features. So how do you incentivize other people? But then the external part is, I guess, networking relationships, which I think for like the MEV space, nobody's really public face. There's very like small amount, because it never really was like that before. So it is interesting how it's kind of shifting. I'm curious to think about, you know, what is the future of MEV in the next year going to be like? Obviously, when you think about exclusive deals, they're going to do it with searches, relays, possibly validators, and even other chains to create some partnership to create cross-chain or cross-domain MEV, right? Or maybe it's like L2 or ZK to L1, you know, all this different kind of stuff. And when you think about really controlling or cornering the entire market of cryptos, you're going to have to establish some strong relationships with people in different chains and different areas of expertise. That's just kind of what I'm seeing right now, until something fundamentally changes at the infrastructure level. That's kind of where we're heading, I think.
Yeah, there are already some experiments where the MEV searching will actually move. There are intents, there is account abstraction, and for example, Flashbots are building Swap, and all these places are basically, or these solutions are trying to figure out how to, let's say, to actually bring these MEV transactions to not just few people, searchers, but to more of them. So when the user says, okay, I want to buy Bitcoin, it actually gets the best price for it, not just the minimum he says in this, let's say, intent one.
Yeah. Intents is interesting. Same with account abstraction. But as you said, you know, if you're kind of forcing everyone to go into public mempool, then they're going to do more backdoor deals. So that's interesting. And I guess if you get enough people, enough searches that are, you know, massive order flow, then you're kind of already winning. You can't really be outcompeted unless you establish connections with, let's say, a protocol like Yearn, for example, or MetaMask, or someone that's actually bringing in a lot of users and kind of privatizing those transactions. Because ultimately, MEV comes from protocols. So they're really at the pinnacle, or I guess they're really the source of all MEV. So it would make sense actually to just team up with protocols, go to the root of the problem and not, you know, I guess controlling the outsource of it, which it makes sense, you know, from search to the builder, now you're controlling all the transactions, but you could go one step further and actually be doing exclusive deals with the protocols themselves and people actually providing the order flow. So having said that, how valuable do you think order flow is, and how do you really monetize it?
I think that's the most valuable thing that you can have. And with the protocols, they don't want to use just one searcher. They want to use as many searchers as possible, as long as they can trust them. Because with that, there's competition, and with competition comes the best final value for the user.
Yeah.
And with that, yeah, I am seeing a lot of deals going on with different protocols and RPCs deciding to select few searchers and send them transactions in order to get some value back to the... And yeah, these are some first steps they're trying to solve. They're trying to figure out how to share or broadcast valuable transactions between some reliable sources.
Mm. If you were an RPC or someone providing an endpoint to, you know, just general public or protocols users, how would you really monetize that order flow that you have? Like, let's say you're now just sending it to the public mempool, but you have all these different people asking you, you know, to do the partnership and whatnot, exclusive deals or whatever. How do these people monetize themselves?
Yeah, usually with every transaction, particularly here we're talking about the swapping. When user exchanges one token for another, there is some slippage. The price deviates from the rest ones. So basically with backrunning, you're leveling it down. and here you're making some profit, and then it needs to be shared, I believe, with the user or with the protocol actually produce this transaction. Of course, searcher here actually did the hard part, actually evaluating and backrunning the transaction. So there must be also some rewards for him. But yeah, eventually the people who gave you the opportunity to do the backrunning should be also rewarded for that.
Yeah, 100%. I wonder if there's any point of, if anyone would pay like 100% of the gas fees, 100% of the MEV, like just completely, like just wipe out competitive, how do I say? Like, how can you compete with someone that's paying for everything, right? You just have to do the same. I wonder if someone would do that to kind of control the order flow. But at that point, it's like, how do you pay for all this stuff as well? Like all the transactions, etc.
So we're basically already seeing that part of it, because few builders are subsidizing blocks from time to time. So they're basically paying for the block that gives them zero value in return. And this happens because they want to increase the number of the blocks, so they can then show the numbers to some business partners and can confirm, look, we're able to do that many blocks at that time. And yeah, something similar is also going on in the individual transactions. With Flashbots, people are already paying, or even in some cases overpaying, the bundles they're constructing. So the user gets something in return, the searcher gets paid, and also the protocol gets some benefits, and also the block builder and validator in this case. It cannot be like it's today, when the validator is basically taking the biggest reward just because he has the final stamp on the block he is actually signing. So I think it should be more distributed between all of the players, because even if some of these players step out of the game, the others will not be able to do the things as they did before.
I wonder your thoughts on like submitting the blocks to relays and having the auctions. You see, they always start very low paying for the block, and then it gets higher to a point of, I wonder, you know, they have their strategies for these as well, because you can have the most profitable block, right? But then you're trying to optimize for, I guess, the least amount to pay for it. So that is another part of the game. So how, man, there's a few strategies. One of the, I had this, like, why wouldn't they just start super high instead of going very low, and then going up and maybe missing out? They could start up high and just wipe out all the competition first, right? Kind of filter them all out, and then they start from a new threshold. I don't know, it's kind of interesting, like these bidding things, but then if that doesn't work, it becomes just a latency game, and how fast can you get, you know, how fast can you ping it for the most recent bid and then send out yours? That's what it seems like.
Yeah, what we're basically seeing today is a combination of both. It's latency and bidding. The strategy you mentioned, that you bid high initially and then decrease the bid. Yeah, I've seen it a few times. But as soon as one guy is actually executes such strategy, the other guys come in and it just vanishes. So yeah, it is an alpha for the first time, and then it's not anymore.
For the blocks, right? Not the actual searches.
Yeah, for the blocks.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember looking at a graph, and there were like a few of them, but then it just kind of went back to normal. So I don't know. I think, yeah, it is ultimately just a latency game, and how much money can you like bid, really? But maybe there is some kind of model. You can create some kind of model to kind of predict or average out, I guess, because it is data at the end of the day. It's a big data play, and you can kind of, I guess, mess around with the averages and experiment with, okay, at this time of the block, you know, auction, they would get around this number, so we have to bid X amount to go higher and kind of guarantee that. And you can keep adjusting anomalies and whatnot. Who's actually auctioning? What do they usually do? I think there's a few things to play around. We are still in like the infancy of this kind of game, I feel like. Even though it doesn't seem like it, you know, things move so quickly in crypto, but there are a lot of things you can experiment with.
Yeah, there are a lot of things going around. It's a pretty interesting and early area, I believe.
No, thinking about the experimental phase we're in now, what are some interesting things you've seen in your time of searching and, you know, block building as well, or just research and development, really?
Well, what we found out is that every chain and every protocol has some specific things. So you cannot just write code once and just works everywhere else. For example, one funny thing happened to us on Avalanche. We just developed a liquidations bot and we decided to turn it on because the market was looking weak at that time. It was not much tested, so we didn't know exactly what to expect. But yeah, we said, turn it on and see what's going on. We went to lunch, and after we came back, I just randomly checked the hot wallets, and all of the fee money was gone. Firstly, I was just shocked, what the hell was going on? But then I quickly realized that there was a lot of profit on the trading contract. So what I did is we drew and refilled the hot wallets, and when I hit the refresh button and no trace, bam, again, all of the money was gone. So I repeated this again and again and again. As soon as the hot wallets were refilled, all of the gas money was gone. And I wasn't transferring just one or two AVAX for gas fees. I was transferring a few hundred AVAX just to cover them. So we catch a lot of liquidations at that time. Later, after the analysis, we concluded that our infrastructure and the bots were able to survive that spike while the competition was having problems of keeping up. So yeah, there is a lot of things that we don't know at the moment, how the chains, nodes, and other infrastructure that's running the blockchain is actually running under huge demand. And we're still learning that. And it was, yes, one of the funniest moments.
You know, at the start of the podcast, you also mentioned you're very into, I guess, long tail, like R&D, basically, researching these new unfound zero-day strategies. And I think that's the most feasible for people entering rather than going straight into liquidations, arbitrage, etc., even though that usually is the de facto standard, thanks to Flashbots and Bert Miller doing those like tutorials, you know, on YouTube and having open source bots basically to tinker around with. I think that's how a lot of people start. And so when we think about long tail, what is really necessary to find strategies? Because it is, the search space is giant. How do you just choose a protocol and go into it and then, I guess, end up finding a strategy? Because it is sometimes, or most of the time, interval with multiple protocols. I guess it really is just like a context thing of you knowing a few protocols and kind of like, oh, wait, this would work here. But is there any kind of like research strategy you've done or developed to really hone in on long tail strategies? I think a lot of people just look at protocols all the time and that's it. So,
but you can look at everything all the time. So what we have is a semi-automated system that basically alerts us when something new and interesting is happening on the blockchain. And at that time, we just go and evaluate. Okay, here's a new protocol. There's a lot of TVL. Let's explore how we can add it into our existing strategies or if there is something new about it. And when we figure things out, we quickly evaluate them. To decide how promising they are. And then if we all agree, we just first build a proof of concept as soon as possible and then deal with the optimizations later, because the game here is to be the first. Even if you have an alpha and you're developing it for half of the year, probably won't be valuable at that time anymore. So you need to be up and running as soon as possible and then deal with the rest. So you're still the fastest one.
Yeah, when I think about that, is my initial thoughts are obviously people are doing the exact same thing of looking for new contracts being deployed, looking into them, maybe filtering by a certain TVL, given enough time, maybe it like scans it for a couple weeks or maybe a week, couple days, see if any money's moved in, etc. So scanning for like events or maybe just transfers to that address. But I think the interesting thing is as well, there's so many contracts on Ethereum and every other chain. If you have some automated system to just go through every single, you know, contract and kind of, how do I explain, like finding how they all relate in different ways, which that is the hard part, first of all. It's not trivial at all. You got to find the relationship between every contract and how you can kind of combine them in different ways to formulate the end goal, which is make money. So you know, when I've been building a fuzzer for like a year, and this is kind of what I've seen, the main thing is, yeah, establishing the relationships and doing it in an automated way, because, you know, the search base is giant. You, let's say, have 10,000 contracts with an average of, you know, maybe let's say 10 functions to go through. So then you have like 10,000 times 10, you have 100,000 possibilities and combinations, well, options rather, not combinations. And so then you combine them all with each other. So it's like 10,000, well, 100,000 times itself, you know, and that's just the surface, because, you know, you can do a sequence of recurrence of the same function, maybe like protocol A, function A, protocol B, function B, protocol A, you know, function A, and then you can combine them infinitely, well, practically until the gas limit, right? But man, there's just so many combinations. So it really comes down to like a, how do you limit search space? And I think the same problem kind of holds true with block building, just maybe not as intense with the amount of combinations, you know?
Oh, it's even bigger.
It's even bigger with block building?
Yeah, because when you're ordering the transactions, you can have a lot of combinations.
Well, it depends how many transactions you get in, right?
Yeah, even just with few 10, you can talk about 10,000 or even more different combinations.
Yeah, but when you talk about, let's say, a smart, you know, every smart contract on Ethereum and all their functions, that's way bigger than, you know, a couple transactions or however many you'd get. So I think it's similar problems, just I think block building might be easier in some ways, but you don't have, it's a time-sensitive operation though with block building. Whereas, you know, doing it just for every smart contract, you could really just let it run for weeks, months.
But here you're assuming that all of these smart contracts are actually compounding between each other.
I mean, you can make them work between each other in some ways, you know, in a custom contract. So that's what I mean, that you got to kind of filter all of them out and make the relationship. You can't really just brute force it, yeah, because it's just so big. Yeah, I'm pretty interested in how these people, these block builders, run their algorithms for filtering combinations. It's a pretty interesting problem, I think.
Yeah, you want to reduce the search spacing as soon as possible. So you're cutting things out as soon as you figure out you don't need them anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like if I was a builder, I would definitely be doing fuzzing. In the heuristics, I would hard code all the main addresses. Like, is this a Uniswap, derived from Uniswap, or interacting with certain contracts? And if it is, maybe prioritize that one over another one. And what kind of presets have I established of, you know, maybe it's a swap, right? And so if you find, let's say nobody actually hits it, but if they do, an arbitrage, then you order it below it and just keep that bundle. Because I believe it's just like they're sending bundles in, right? So you already have these preset bundles and you have to find for conflicting ones, etc. So you have to order them instead. So yeah, that kind of analysis would be interesting as well. A lot of like mix and match.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Man, I'm pretty keen to see the future of this, but you also done a lot of math in the past as well. How do you think that can be used or applied to searching and block building? Obviously, you can use it for arbitrage and optimization of pathways, but is there anything that it's particularly useful in these realms?
Yeah, it's in these areas you mentioned. So I've graduated from computer science and mathematics. And in college, I learned a lot about theoretical applications from different mathematical fields like linear algebra, calculus, and graph theory. And this knowledge was very useful when I started developing, because basically I was able to transfer it into an actual practice. And for the MEV bots in particular, and also for the block building, there can be many interesting applications. Like, for example, as you mentioned, the searching for the path finding. In the early days, you could just construct the graph of all possible pools and then relations between them. And then, for example, on each block, you could just run then some modified version of searching algorithm and find out whether there is a profitable atomic arbitrage or not. One of such algorithms is, for example, Belmont-Ford, which can detect negative cycles. And this means if we construct the graph in a way that lines between the nodes represent the negative values of the logarithm of conversion ratio, we we can actually make the money if we find and go along that negative cycle. So logarithms here are used to convert conversion rate multiplication to addition, because that's a cheaper operation. And we're interested in negative cycles because in financial context, values less than one represent a decrease or a loss. So if we take a logarithm such value, we get negative numbers. And in this case, negative cycles would then represent a series of trades that we want to avoid. But if we flip the signs, we can basically turn around the problem, and such negative cycles can quickly become a profitable arbitrage path. So yeah, this, for example, is an example of graph theory that becomes very useful. Another pretty interesting thing for us was when you're working on Ethereum, there is not a lot of pools. And when you switch to BSC, there's more than 1.5 million units of V2 pools, and the blocks are 3 seconds long. So everything should be 10 times faster than on Ethereum. So what we did is here to do basically a generation and cache all of the possible arbitrage paths at the beginning. And we were playing around with different searching algorithms, like Johnson's algorithm, which was working pretty okay. But at the end, because there is a lot of these pools, we just took a little bit more memory intensive algorithm to generate all of the paths, and that's it. And for this Uniswap V2 pools, another interesting thing also appears when you try to visualize these curves. If you look really carefully, you can see that these curves are very special. They have some special characteristic that can help you reduce the number of searching steps when calculating the optimal amount to trade. So this is where some basic calculus becomes very useful. And also, when you're entering the world of parallel computing, you need to be very careful with your data structures, and particularly how related and frequently used data is stored in the memory. So this is called memory locality and can give you a significant performance boost if you implement it correctly. Here is where linear algebra with the matrices and vectors becomes very useful. Yeah. We know its applications from machine learning, but it's also very useful for parallel fast execution, because you can peg the data closely and can be also very specific on which parts of the data should be used for a given calculation. So basically, this allows the CPU to preload related data into the same registers and avoid additional memory lookup when doing calculations. And then you can leverage the SIMD, single instruction, multiple data, CPU instructions, that enable you to batch multiple calculations in single instructions. So yeah, mathematics can be very useful if you know how to transfer the theoretical knowledge in practice. We're basically doing this every day, because when you're developing and coding, you have different strategies and protocols you're dealing with, and probably all of them are including some simple mathematical problems you're basically solving when doing and implementing them.
Yeah, I think math is a very underrated skill, because, I mean, if you combine it with programming skill, you're kind of already got an edge over other people, other developers, unless they're, you know, similar kind of thinking and they're also got the math background. But it just levels out the playing field, or maybe gives you an edge over others. But it also helps you think of new solutions and be more creative, because you have more knowledge that all kind of help each other. For example, I've been learning a bit about AI, and it's pretty correlated to fuzzing. So I've been able to apply instantly, basically, really basic high-level understandings of topics to my fuzzer, like a reward function, a cost function, all that stuff, to help. Because at the time, I didn't know, I guess, the actual terms, the definitions, etc., and how they were useful specifically, and how to apply them. The more knowledge you can get in fields that kind of relate in some ways, you're way better off in the creativity realm, because you have more context, and when you have more context, you can think.
But the more you play around, the more you learn, the more you research, and so you get to think, to know things better and better and better, and this just compounds. And That's also something similar with mathematics, as you mentioned. You see something on one field, and then you need to step out of the box and explore, oh, is that useful somewhere else? Yeah, programming and mathematics are very related.
Yeah, and you build the intuition as well. I think it's worth doing, even though people might think, you know, math's not for them. I think always give it a good shot of like a couple months before you make that decision, you know? It's always like the hardest things are worth doing. So that's what I'm doing, at least. Even though I'm not like particularly a big fan of math, I'm starting to develop that kind of that interest after going at it for a while. You know, instead of, you know, you see this mountain, you're finally climbing it. It kind of gets fun, you know, the journey instead of, I guess, the destination. It's always hard starting. You know?
Yeah, it's hard starting. But I would recommend everyone to start because the longer you're dealing with it, the more beautiful and funny things come out of it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. But man, I'm super excited for the future of crypto and also your career. I think it's going to be quite interesting to see how we all progress. And even the MEV space, it's an interesting field. And who knows what's going to happen in the next year. I think the bull market is probably going to be next year as well. With the halving. So it's going to be a crazy time, and hopefully we make it, or we just stay poor forever.
Yeah, no, we're all going to make it.
This is such cope. But man, thank you so much for jumping on. I really appreciate the time and speaking to you. You know, obviously you're busy and whatnot. So yeah, hopefully this helps in any way it can. Hopefully people send their order flow to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for all the listeners for staying with us for the past hour. Hopefully you found something interesting between the lines. And yeah, thank you, Digachi, for hosting me. It was my first podcast and I really enjoyed it. So until next time, see ya.
Thanks so much, Christian. And we'll probably speak again later in the future as well. Until then, take care.